Welcome to the Writer's Voice. I'm Patty Campbell for the Virginia Voice, and today we welcome Professor Roger E. Kirch. Dr. E. Kirch is a professor at Virginia Tech, and he has written a new book that is being published this month called Birthright, The True Story That Inspired Kidnapped. So, welcome, Roger.
Thank you very much, Patty.
It is great to have you here.
My pleasure.
You live in Roanoke, teach at Virginia Tech. I see that you are a specialist in colonial America and the American Revolution. So how does Kidnapped and the story behind Kidnapped come out of all of that?
In recent years, much of my writing has actually taken on a more European flavor. A book I wrote titled At Day's Close was set largely in pre-modern Europe. And my courses at Virginia Tech are indeed devoted to the colonial period and the American Revolution, but in terms of my writing, I pretty much go where the story seems most fascinating or the topic. And in this case, I had written a book published in 1987 by Oxford that was entitled Bound for America, that dealt with the transportation of British convicts to Virginia and Maryland primarily during the 18th century. I became vaguely aware with the story of James Annesley that Birthright revolves around, but at that time didn't give much credit to it, nor did other historians. Only about 7 years ago did I, by pure luck in researching something altogether different, did I come across a reference that utterly convinced me that the rumors about James Annesley's kidnapping were indeed correct, and caused me to probe further to discover a veritable treasure trove of legal documents relating to the entirety of his life.
And he is the person Robert Louis Stevenson loosely based his book on?
Yes. The Annesley abduction in the 18th century. Probably no story of personal hardship so captivated the British public during the 1700s. Inspired as many as five novels.
Do we know any of those other novels, like we know Kidnapped?
The best known would be Sir Walter Scott's Guy Mannering, which was published in 1817. Stevenson, to my knowledge, never acknowledged his debt to the Annesley saga. I am totally confident that this provided him with the basic plot of a young heir who was denied by a wicked uncle his birthright and then sent to America as a servant. At that point, the novel Kidnapped takes a very different turn, and indeed the protagonist, David Balfour, does not end up in the colonies, as in reality James Annesley did. Balfour is shipwrecked off the coast of England and makes his way back to Scotland, which is another principal difference between the novel and the real-life saga of Annesley, which is set largely in Ireland. We know that Stevenson was a voracious reader. He was learned in the law. He read anything and everything. He would have had to have been a hermit in a cave in the far reaches of the Scottish Highlands not to have been familiar with the Annesley saga, especially since it inspired not only the novel by Scott, but several others, as I've mentioned, including one that was well publicized in 1783, entitled The Wandering Heir. But most important is that there's just no other explanation for the degree to which the plot and kidnapped. Again, a heir denied his birthright by a wicked uncle, sent to America. The congruence between that and what actually happened during the previous century.
Now, when you were doing your research and you came upon this story of Annesley, was there an aha moment? Was there a moment when you said, this is kidnapped?
Well, I should confess, I'm probably one of the few people who never read Kidnapped as a child. Everybody tells me that they have.
That surprises me.
Yes. It's a beloved novel, especially in Britain, evidently. Tony Blair's favorite childhood boy's adventure story, and also a favorite of Sean Connery, who several years ago was employed to undrape a statue showing images in marble of David Balfour, the protagonist, and his wicked uncle side by side. But to answer your question more directly, I became progressively convinced of the connection. The more I learned about Annesley's saga, the strong similarities, the fact, again, that any number of books, and for that matter, articles written in the 19th century, talked about the Annesley life and his tribulations. I should add as well that reviewers of Kidnapped, including one very prominent review in the Athenaeum, arguably London's premier literary magazine, in 1886, in reviewing the novel Kidnapped, the reviewer himself had utterly no doubt that this was indeed the inspiration for Stevenson's Kidnapped. If I could just briefly quote what he wrote in his review, which I include in a footnote toward the end of the book, of both Guy Mannering, he wrote, and Kidnapped, the main action was suggested by the Annesley case, that marvelous romance of real life, which in The Wandering Heir, that was the novel that appeared in 1873, not even Charles Reade, who was the author of that novel, could effectually vulgarize and spoil for future use. And no doubt it may be said that in David Balfour's struggle with old Ebenezer, that being the wicked uncle, mm-hmm. there is nothing so improbable as the real struggle of Annesley with his wicked uncle, and that Annesley's adventures in the plantations surpass in wonderfulness any of the escapes and disasters that befell Balfour.
I want to ask you about your research.
I travel, depending upon the nature of my research and the book that I'm working on, I travel fairly widely, but in this day and age, a tremendous amount of primary information can be obtained online, or at least ordered. Photocopies can be ordered online from such repositories as the British Library and the British Public Record Office outside of London. That said, for Birthright, I traveled to do research at both, looking into records that I could not obtain photocopies of. And indeed, probably the high point of the research for me was the trip that I paid to both Northern Ireland, Belfast in particular, which has a tremendous public record office of its own, and to Dublin in Ireland, which also included a visit to County Wexford, the town of New Ross, lying some 70 miles southwest of Dublin, where I was invited by the current owners of Dunmain, the house in which James Annesley in 1715 was born, and which at least in terms of the exterior, has not changed one iota except for the addition of a portico at some point in its long history since its construction in the late 17th century. The family there were absolutely wonderful. The Conway family, it's been in their possession for the last roughly 100 years, and they gave me a tour, had me over for lunch, and I like to think we've become good friends.
It's very exciting when it moves past the papers and the research and becomes sort of touchable and real, isn't it?
Very much so. That was the highlight of my trip to Dublin. The second most exciting incident was joining 12 young boys. I kept wondering, where are their parents? From Dublin in a Zodiac, which is one of these inflatable rubber boats that moves at a very, very fast speed. And I hasten to add, the operator of the Zodiac, for a long tour of the Bay of Dublin. The boys couldn't have been nicer.
Fun, or was that related to the research? Too?
Well, that's what the person that gave me some grant money inquired. but in point of fact, some of the most interesting action in the book takes place in the Bay of Dublin, which is precisely where young Jemmy Annesley, Jemmy was his childhood name, after being kidnapped by his uncle, was taken and put aboard ship.
Sounds like research to me.
It was on a brilliant July day, and being out in that bay, it easily could have been the 18th century.
Are you starting to get any sense of how the book will be received?
I'm hopeful. It's a tremendous story. Whether I've done justice to it or not, I'll leave that for readers and reviewers to decide on their own. The pre-publication reviews, which are limited to a handful of publications suited for libraries and bookstores, have been very encouraging. So
that feels good, doesn't it?
I was very pleased, and I'm starting to get invitations to give talks here and there, and to give interviews in addition to appearing here today. This is the first, though, and I'm very grateful for that.
Will you read some to us?
It would be my delight. I thought I would read the prologue, which is designed to basically set the stage for the book, though it actually falls about a third of the way chronologically through the story. But it's the most arresting set of events, I think it is fair to say, in a family drama of numerous twists and turns that from beginning to end plays out over as many as seven decades, and attracts the attention of the King of England, George II, who asked to meet with James Annesley. Even after James Annesley's death and the death of his uncle, King George III has a very important role to play in the way that the story ends. There's a old French proverb to the effect, though many others have claimed it as their own, to the effect that revenge is a dish best eaten cold, even from the grave in the case of James Annesley. And George III played a role in the story's outcome. But let me begin with the prologue, which in itself begins with a epigram. To commit the care of a minor to him who is the next in succession to him is like committing the lamb to be devoured by the wolf. Sir John Fortescue, 1471. The crier's elegy echoes in the bleak evening air as the barefoot boy darts off in the direction of Christ Church. Across Ormond Bridge, where fluttering oil lamps cast a feeble glow, to Wood Quay on the south bank of the River Liffey. Damp cobblestones likely slow his pace ahead of Pudding Row. No street urchin knows the waterside better, its wide quays, market stalls, and gabbard men. A winding passage strewn with rubbish empties past the sign of the palm tree into Wine Tavern Street, the heart of Dublin's old city. Catching his breath, Jemmy climbs Cock Hill to reach the cathedral grounds, anxiously pushing past a sparse crowd that has gathered for his father's funeral. On the night of November 16, 1727, less than 24 hours after his sudden death, mourners inter the remains of Arthur Annesley, 4th Baron Altham. Only 38, he died with his mistress by his side early that morning in bed. Coughing uncontrollably and unable to stand, he began to lose his sight while a servant cradled his head. "Lord, have mercy on my soul," he at last muttered. "I am going into another world." The ceremony bears little resemblance to a traditional Irish wake. No fiddles or ballads or whiskey to lighten hearts. Instead, somber footmen with torches lead the bereaved, draped in mourning scarves, from a still column of coaches. In recent years, the city's Protestant aristocracy has adopted the English fashion of staging nocturnal funerals. These occasions are smaller and more private, and as such have the virtue of being less expensive. A lone chaplain, attended by a verger, presides. The darkness lends an element of solemnity, absent from much of the baron's life. A massive Romanesque edifice dating from the High Middle Ages, the Church of the Holy Trinity, properly known as Christ Church, sits atop a summit overlooking the Liffey as it flows through the city toward the sea. A venerable Gothic pile, in the words of an 18th century writer. The cathedral, a favorite place of worship for the country's Lord Lieutenant, the King's preeminent representative in Ireland, has become a bastion of the Anglo-Irish establishment. That alone, however derelict Altham's own attendance, makes the church a natural resting place. It is not Jemmy's young age, 12 years, that gives him away, nor his dress. Long ago, his feather hat and scarlet jacket were abandoned for tattered breeches and a soiled coat, not unlike the ragtag garb of blackguard boys drawn that night by curiosity to the church. More revealing is the youth's weeping, rare among others in attendance, including the baron's younger brother, Richard. My father, Jemmy finally blurts out as pallbearers descend narrow steps to place the coffin inside the church's ancient crypt. So stunned is a mourner that she quickly spins the boy around, begging to know his identity. Lord Altham's son, he declares, and with that he is off, tears streaming from his eyes all the way to Phoenix Street and the abode of John Purcell the butcher. For more than 3 years, Jemmy Annesley has roamed old Dublin's maze of bylanes and crooked streets with their rows of red brick houses capped by roofs of blue slate. Although Ireland is predominantly Catholic, the capital is two-thirds Protestant and the stronghold of the country's ruling elite. It is also a flourishing port, boasting 92,000 residents in 1725, second in the British Isles only to the population of London. Dublin, nonetheless, still has the physical appearance of a large European town. Its area, a contemporary estimates, comprises just one-third of London's vast expanse, and unlike the broad swath cut by the Thames, the Liffey, whose shallow channel does not permit ships with freight beyond the customs house at Essex Bridge, measures fewer than 170 feet in breadth. With some exaggeration, a visitor observes, "Dublin is like a large market town in England where everyone knows and is known by everybody." This intimate, bustling metropolis, its familiar ways and customs, Jemmy has come to know firsthand after being turned out at age 8 by his father in the spring of 1724. For several months, father and son dwelled north of the Liffey on Frapper Lane, just to the west of Green Market. A neighborhood school offered instruction in English and Latin. But once the Baron, together with Miss Gregory, removed to the suburban village of Inchicore, the boy was put to board on the south side of the river. Over the water, as a person later says. In the shadow of Dublin Castle, the residence of the Lord Lieutenant, Jemmy lives on Little Ship Street, just the first of several stops in coming months. No one spot keeps him for long. Once he makes the short journey on foot to Inchicore, only to be turned away at his father's door. By Christmas time, Jemmy has returned to Frapper Lane, where he occasionally sleeps in the hayloft of a playfellow's home. Then, for nearly 2 years, he works as a shoeboy along Inns Quay, employing a mixture of lamp black and eggs for polish, and a rag or tattered wig for a cloth. He also runs errands as a scull for students at Trinity College, despite his rumored notoriety as a nobleman's son. "You little rogue, you often say you are Lord Altham's son," a young scholar scolds one day. "Now tell me the truth, are you or aren't you?" "Indeed, indeed, I am my Lord and Lady Altham's son," Jemmy protests. Nights find him sleeping in a doorway, or curled beneath a vendor's stall, like hundreds of other destitute children in Dublin streets. "Whole swarms of bastards," rails a writer, "that should be shipped off to the wildest of our plantations abroad." When taxed for his gross neglect, Altham blames his mistress, to whom the profligate baron has become indebted in the amount of £500. "That bitch will not suffer me to do anything for him," he protests to a confidant. In the spring of 1727, 3 years after leaving Frapper Lane, he does at last arrange for Jemmy to lodge with an old acquaintance, Dominic Farrell, a humble linen dealer. Within 2 months, however, Jemmy again is forced to fend for himself. The peddler's wife cares little for the baron, who owes Farrell a debt, or consequently for his boy. So it is fortunate that Dominic should encounter his friend, John Purcell, one Wednesday afternoon 3 weeks later. The butcher resides with his wife 2 blocks north of Erin Quay, and though they already have a son, the couple is anxious for another. The two men find Jemmy in Smithfield Cattle Market, all in wigs and tatters, with a straw rope around his waist as he leads a horse for sale. Asked his name, he responds, "James Annesley, son to Lord and Lady Altham." Once Purcell invites him to join his household, the boy drops to his knees in gratitude. "I'm almost lost," he mumbles. Taking the boy's hand, the burly butcher replies, "Well, sir, have a good heart." Home lies a short distance away. "There is a present for you," Purcell announces to his wife. "I desire you will take care of him, for he has no friends to do it." That evening, I'm being scrubbed head to foot in a kitchen tub with a wedge of soap, water, and bran. Jemmy is put to bed in a clean shirt. "While I have a bit of bread for my own child," Mrs. Purcell promises, "you shall never want." An affable man, Purcell follows a rough trade. Butchers are a stout lot whose ranks dominate the neighborhood bordering the slaughterhouses of Ormond Market. Mostly Catholic, they frequently battle the city's Protestant weavers. Only constables and bailiffs, with whom both butchers and weavers scuffle, inspire greater hatred. On a fall afternoon, barely 3 weeks before Lord Altham's death, a gentleman pays the Purcells a visit. To augment their modest living, the couple keep a tippling house, and the stranger, who arrives with a fusel and a setting dog, requests a pot of beer. "Do you," he asks the butcher, "have a boy in the house named James Annesley?" "Yes," replies Purcell, calling the boy hesitantly from the fireside once and then a second time. Stricken with fear, his eyes beginning to moisten, Jemmy whispers to Mammy, Purcell's wife, "That is my Uncle Dick." "So, Jemmy," questions Captain Richard Annesley, "how do ye do?" Bowing, the boy replies, "Thank God, very well." In fact, he has just recovered from smallpox, and his face still bears a red rash. "Don't you know me?" inquires the gentleman. "Yes," comes the reply, "you are my Uncle Annesley." "Jemmy," continues Richard, "I think Providence was very good to you, to put you into such hands to take care of you." More questions follow. Does Purcell intend to keep Jemmy as an apprentice? "No," the butcher replies, "being bred to such a slavish business himself, he does not think it proper to take a gentleman's son to make a butcher. Instead, he expresses the wish that father and son might be reunited." On a separate occasion, Jemmy himself has told Purcell that he yet hopes to succeed his father. Nor, in response to Richard's query, will Purcell accept money for the boy's board. Finally, after pledging to inform Lord Altham of Jemmy's circumstances, Uncle Dick departs. What, if anything, is reported, we do not know. Tempted himself to visit Altham, Purcell is strongly discouraged by friends. "They told me he was a passionate little man, and by reason of the whore he kept in his house, he would not matter to shoot me." It does not appear that Jemmy and his uncle speak at the Baron's funeral. No eyewitness reports even a cursory exchange. Clearly, however, the boy's sudden appearance at Christ Church makes a deep impression on the small gathering of mourners, not least on Richard Annesley himself, who not incidentally seeks to be enrolled in his brother's place as Baron Altham. Afterward, during a heated meeting in Dublin Castle, the King-at-Arms, the country's senior herald, initially refuses to certify the title, an essential step before the Lord Chancellor can grant a writ of summons to the House of Lords. Owing to the boy's great noise at the funeral, it seems to many that the late Lord has left a son and a legitimate heir at that. Over the next few days, any mention of the funeral elicits a torrent of invective from Richard, who rails that the boy is a vagabond and an impostor. Ever since, Richard complains, he cannot make his appearance at the castle or anywhere but that he was insulted. An attorney counsels forbearance. If the boy is a bastard, he will be found out. If a vagrant, he might be shipped as a servant to America. Except for a few patches of sunlight, December brings gray skies, rain, and fog. It is during the first week that an unfamiliar servant appears one morning on Phoenix Street. Jemmy, he says, is summoned to Ormond Market by his uncle. Can he come right away? A cudgel in one hand, John Purcell hoists the lad by the other. A short walk brings them to the George, a tavern in Bow Lane, where Richard, newly titled Baron Altham, stands inside with the owner, Mr. Jones. Joining them in the cramped alehouse are a constable and several odd-looking fellows. Removing his hat, the butcher bids them good morning. "How do you do, Mr. Purcell?" replies the uncle. Still in mourning, he is dressed totally in black. Then, pointing to Jemmy, he instructs a figure by the door, "Hark you, sir, take that thieving son of a whore." Before anyone can act, Purcell presses Jemmy between his legs. Striking the constable with a cudgel, he vows, "Whoever suffers to do him mischief, by all that's good, I'll knock his brains out." Furious, Richard insists that the boy will be transported to the colonies. "By God, he shall not stay in the kingdom. I will send him to the devil." But no one dares test the butcher's mettle. Then, with his eyes fixed on the baron, Purcell declares, "You make a good appearance of a gentleman, and I am surprised that you should show so much revenge and so much malice as to say that you will destroy this poor creature." It is a remarkable outburst for a humble tradesman. Grasping his sword, Richard swears that he will stick Purcell to the wall. But a band of butchers, hearing the fracas, arrives outside, scattering the baron and his men. "I have more friends here than you have," warns Purcell. This first skirmish ends in a draw, but Annesley's business is not done. Jemmy's anxiety only deepens over the winter. Before, he ran errands, but on most days he now lingers inside the Purcells' home. More than once, strangers are seen lurking outdoors. One even attempts to enter the tiny yard, only to bolt like a buck upon the butcher's approach. In early February, nearly 9 months after his arrival, Jemmy makes off, increasingly fearful of being abducted. For a short spell, he resides as a servant at the nearby home of Richard Teague, a prominent attorney. Perhaps the boy gambles that Teague's home will afford the safer haven. If so, he miscalculates. The early days of spring see strong gusts, hail, and drenching rains. The swollen Liffey tops its banks, flooding homes and workshops. Mud, tree limbs, and animal carcasses lie everywhere. But brightening skies in April draw Jemmy outdoors, prompted by his master's inattention. For more than a month, Annesley's servants have scoured likely haunts, including Smithfield on the north side of the Liffey and College Green and Newmarket to the south. Then on April 30th, a Monday, the boy is sighted at Ormond Market, not far from John Purcell's empty butcher stall, nabbed and brought once again to the George. The baron has left little to chance. Along with servants, he commands two constables, each promised half a guinea. Richard alleges that the boy has stolen a silver spoon. Neither constable bears a warrant, but their presence gives the abduction a whiff of legality. "Do this job for me," Richard promises one, "and I will make a man of you all the days of your life." Even so, the market is unfriendly terrain, and by now Jemmy is crying uncontrollably, certain that he will either be murdered or transported. As they force their way on foot toward the quay, a crowd of people has formed in the bright sunlight, their numbers growing by the minute. This is the mob, laborers, tradesmen, and servants, that so frightens Dublin's respectable classes. Nor do such folk have any fondness for kidnapping, an occasional expedient employed by ship captains to fill their holds. It is a short walk to the north end of Essex Bridge, where in front of a dilapidated watch house, the constables bundle the boy into a coach. Still the curious throng follows, across the Liffey to Custom House Quay and Temple Bar, ultimately as far as George's Quay, over half a mile down river, where convicts and indentured servants customarily embark for the colonies. "What is the matter?" ask several persons in the crowd. For all the commotion, none in the end interferes, nor does anyone in a position of authority step forward. These, after all, are deeply troubled times. The impetus for Jonathan Swift's sardonic proposal to cannibalize the babies of starving paupers. The economy lies in ruins, and Dublin all of a sudden faces an influx of vagabonds, with boys no older than Jemmy already transported for their poverty. Housebreakings and street robberies are spreading. Recent crop failures across much of the country have triggered fresh fears of famine, never far from an Irishman's mind. Given the presence of constables, the commotion on George's Quay, at least to some onlookers, may appear less like a kidnapping than punishment sanctioned by a court. Probably none too soon. Uncle Dick is the first to descend the stone steps of the slip to the longboat, followed by the two constables and Jemmy. Exhausted from crying, the boy falls silent as the men begin to row toward Ring's End, a tiny fishing village perched on a tongue of land barely a mile to the east. There, riding at anchor, where the Liffey enters Dublin Bay, is the James, a ship of 100 tons loaded with servants. Runs abreast, Jemmy's uncle escorts him aboard and returns minutes later to the waiting boat. A large buoy bobs in the distance, with mighty Howth Head lying just to the northeast. As night comes on, the James prepares to make its way over the bar with the shifting tide.
The prologue from Birthright, the true story that inspired Kidnapped, read by its author, Dr. Roger E. Kirch. Roger, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
I'm Patty Campbell. You're listening to The Writer's Voice on The Virginia Voice.